This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Arman Shrocki. Each week, Arman will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hi, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. This week is a special week for us. I have not just a great entrepreneur person to join our show, but also a great friend, which I know for decades. So Sid, thank you very much for joining me. And we are so glad you are here.
Thank you, Arman. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? It's better for you to tell it more accurately. I can't tell a lot, but I'd rather for people to hear it from you directly. You are very accomplished in aspect of, you know, what you have done, and don't be humble. Please tell us about yourself, your story, and, you know, where you are and what you're doing.
Okay, I appreciate that. I'll try to not be too boastful. I've had an interesting, I think, career over the last 20, really almost 30 years now, but focusing on the last 20 or so. In the 90s, I was focusing on helping a friend of mine who started a company build a business intelligence software company and platform, a company called MicroStrategy. I left that company in 2001 and started the first of two of my own companies. One was a consulting business that was really designed around helping organizations, both public and private sector, build analytic applications that could drive better understanding, better efficiencies, better kind of value in the way that they used information to make decisions. And then the most recent company that I've been associated with for, almost 15, 16 years now, it was a company called Clarabridge, which we founded in 2006. And over the period of 2006 to the present day, used to build essentially a platform that could make sense of unstructured data. The text and the language and the words you typically associate with not just feedback from things like surveys, but also calls, chats, emails, social media. And we use that information to help organizations better understand and get closer to and more responsive to their customers. So we kind of focus the business on an area that's nowadays called customer experience. And I was the CEO of that business for about 15 years. In 2021, I sold the business to a larger company called Qualtrics, which has historically been known for market research and kind of feedback collection for using traditional survey techniques. And I've been working now with Qualtrics for the last couple of years as a chief strategy officer. So that's my history in brief.
Fantastic. I know that through the experience and what you have done, you have always been very consistently looking for what kind of value you can create for the customers. So always that has been the North Star from your point of view when you are thinking about product that guides you to provide and create and offer the best product. Can you tell us a little bit about that part?
Sure. Yeah, I think I appreciate the question. One of the things I think I learned early on, even when I was working at the analytics company MicroStrategy, was that there were a lot of companies that were creating interesting technologies, and that the companies that tended to do the best were very keen to listen to and understand what their customers were trying to do, right? What they were trying to do with the business challenges they were trying to accomplish. And when you try to sell anybody a software solution or a SaaS solution, you have to justify that what you're giving them is going to create some value proposition that can be typically measured not in years or, you know, long time frames, but in, you know, in periods of time that can be tactical in the short term, but also strategic in the long term. And so when we first started working with specifically the Clarabridge business, the idea that formed the company was we think that the world is ready to analyze text. That's not a value driver, right? It was more of a hypothesis. It says right now people have been historically analyzing rows and columns of data, you know, think data in sales figures or financial data or supply chain data. And we think that that problem has largely been solved. The next big problem is going to be, how do I make sense of interactions like this, right? Two people talking on a webcast or on a phone call, trying to solve a problem or buy something or get technical support. And so we started prototyping the technology, but very quickly we realized when we were using it and, you know, showing customers and running prototypes that we were doing things much faster than they could do before, right? If you have to listen to a call for quality purposes or read all the feedback from all the online reviews or social media or surveys that somebody's capturing, it takes a lot of time. You can't do it all very effectively. And if you can automate the reading of feedback or the automate the quality scoring of a phone call, you create an insight faster. You do it for less time, which is less money, and you can make a decision to change something more quickly before a bad experience or a bad product basically causes more harm to your business. So there's sort of three value drivers. A, you're saving money, right? Because you're doing something faster and cheaper. B, you're actually driving an insight to an action faster, so you can catch something before it creates a bigger drain on the overall business kind of ability to act on a negative interaction. And then C, when you make that change, you're actually creating customer satisfaction better than maybe a competitor. And so that customer that does business with your customer, the company that's buying your software, is more likely to make more money, right? You're making money, you're saving money, and you're managing change more effectively. And that kind of was the epiphany that hit us pretty early on, 2007-08 timeframe, where we said we need to ground all of the innovation we do around these ideas of helping companies do things to more efficiently, save money, have better outcomes that drive more loyalty and make money, and then provide the tools and the techniques to manage through change with continuous improvement. And it's a big part of how we think about every innovation that we take. It also helps us because when you're selling your software to a customer, a business customer, and they say, well, how much does it cost? And if you can't articulate the cost in terms of the value, but as I'm sure you know, we've all been doing this for many years in our business, you know, the first response is, well, that seems high. I want it for less money. And I have to be able to go back to the customer and say, well, I could give you less money, but it would be less capacity. But if I give you more value, you'll actually make more money. You'll save more money. And that also led us to a secondary observation, which is when you're selling a disruptive new technology, oftentimes your customer or prospective customer doesn't believe that you can show value. So we concluded very early on that we needed to show them. And so a big part of how we've been going to business, going to market for many years is to say, we're going to position the software for value, but then we're going to say, if you don't believe us, let us show you, let us show you with your data. We'll bring data from your business into our platform and we'll prove it to you with a proof of concept. And it costs time and effort for us, but in the grand scheme of things, it helps to persuade that prospective customer that the solution will drive value. Right? And the last thing I'll mention about this is, you know, SaaS solutions, unlike, you know, something that's custom built or, you know, old fashioned products where you would just install and you'd sell the product once, right? And then you just have a smaller maintenance stream that you collect later. With SaaS solutions, every year you have to basically renew that customer to buy at least as much as they bought the previous year, if not more. And so having that focus on value that you can always show justifies using the solution, I think, is a big part of how I think you can build a sustainable and growing business.
Great point. Absolutely. Yeah. So you're right. Even considering the subscription nature of SaaS, it's even more important to really have a good ROI and create the value. Right. Otherwise, the business will suffer. Now, with regard to, of course, you are coming from analytic world, data, everything that even customer experience is more based on the text that you ingest, you review, automate. Now, with these new technologies, AI-related technologies in the market, how do you see that can improve and change these in a more accelerated value that can be offered to the market?
Yeah, I mean, a good question. The market that we've been in with, you know, with our solution over the last 15 years has very much evolved dramatically. When we first started Clarabridge as a, you know, as an early stage SaaS company, and we were trying to understand language, we initially, and this was probably for the first 5 years or so, from 2006 to sort of 2011, a lot of the analytics were coded, right? We use in language analytics, you can think of sort of business rule driven, you know, coding of language. So you say, if I see these words and they're ordered or kind of sequenced in this way, then I know that I'm picking up a particular topic or a particular risk marker or a particular quality marker. And so we had to hard code a lot of this stuff. That was for the first 5 years. By 2011, 12, and this was a couple of years after some of the early deep learning algorithms were being put into the public domain through open source technologies, we realized that we could actually use training sets and machine learning to train our platform to recognize patterns. And so you wouldn't have to code everything by hand. And that allowed us to be able to much more rapidly evolve the way that we teased out insights from language. Mm-hmm. And we identified that there were kind of two primary concepts that we wanted to extract from language, much like the human brain does. When you think about left brain and right brain, right? The left brain is how you process things in kind of a logical and organized way. You look for, categories or interactions or product names or the stages of a customer journey. Those are all very kind of specific and targeted things that you pull out from language. But you also look for the right brain, and the right brain is sort of the artistic, the creative, the qualitative markers. And this is where you find things like emotion and love and hate and frustration and effort. And the qualitative ways that people describe things that are both good and bad and everywhere in the middle. And so we recognize that we can train on very specific rules that can be rule-based, the things to look for. But sometimes language is very nuanced. People use many different ways of expressing anger or frustration or love. That was a technique where we needed to really use machine learning and AI. And so we initially started using AI for the right brain capabilities because we figured that was going to be much more difficult to think about all the different ways people use language. Eventually, we started using AI on the left brain features as well. And that when we started doing that, we were able to dramatically expand how the product supported different kinds of use cases. So we when we deploy the solution now, we say we have about 150 different models that people can use to analyze things. And you know, when we deploy our solution, it might be for a bank where we want to know all the different journeys that a customer has when they talk about opening an account or servicing account or complaining about a particular thing that they don't expect in their statement. That's a journey model. We have product models. We have regulatory risk models where we can detect if someone is, you know, in an email or calling or posting a review about the fact that a bank might have charged them for something that they didn't expect to be charged for. Now, that's not just a complaint. If a bank has too many of those complaints, that's a regulatory issue, right? Mm-hmm. So we can actually surface that a bank might have some operational risk markers in the way their customers are experiencing products and services. And if we find that risk marker before the regulators do, we can help the bank fix the problem, right? So that the bank doesn't have to pay a big fine or have to have a bunch of corrective measures after the fact. So we found that AI allowed us to quickly kind of rapidly scale out a wide range of different models to make sense of language and customer experiences. And where we are now is we're actually finding that the current generation of AI, which, you know, Gen AI, the ChatGPT type of technologies, is uniquely good, not just at recognizing and tagging patterns in language. It's actually very good at synthesizing insights and even recommendations, so that an organization doesn't have to find something in a traditional kind of analytic view or report. They can have the ChatGPT look at all the data and say, this is what you should do. This is the problem. This is the solution. So we're effectively letting the machine even do a better job of not just finding, but remedying a problem. And so we're now starting to incorporate generative AI into creating more derived insights, not just analytics, and even creating recommendations and suggested actions so that organizations can actually use the machine to not just find the needle in the haystack, but figure out what the solution to the problem is that's coming up. And as each generation of AI is kind of maturing, a big question, again, back to value, is if I can use this technology to create more value, and I can do it faster than my competitors, I can build my business more effectively. And I can also make sure that my customers continue to get more value from my solution.
Fantastic. With that, of course, comes this aspect of consistency and staying on the course. And this, when you are an entrepreneur and not just you are linking value to what you offer and all of these new technologies, AI is going to just accelerate it. But as you mentioned, you have done it nonstop as an entrepreneur. You never stopped just, you know, taking your eyes from the kind of dot and just getting there every single day and just consistently having that kind of, you know, goal until you hit it, because it's not going to be accomplished very quickly. And as I hear from you in everything that comes, even new technologies like AI we are talking about, still you go back to the same North Star that you had in mind and you said, okay, this is the value I'm going to offer. Now, if you wanted to formalize it and say, you know, AI in summary, in the kind of work that you are doing, the best use cases you have seen for AI are these. What are those low-hanging fruits or the use cases that you can see quickly can add value to customers?
So I have seen some themes, right? Again, when we deploy, and again, I will say that there's a kind of another decision point that I realized early on with certainly with the Clarabridge business, is that when you start a company, particularly a SaaS company, there's competing pressures. Pressure one is to go wide, right? To solve as many use cases as you can. And pressure two is to go deep, right? Focus on a very, very specific problem you want to solve and do it deeply and more specifically than other vendors. And our business has kind of ebbed and flowed where we've gone wide and then we've kind of tested out where we can create the most value. And then if some areas aren't working out, then we go deep. Right. And then we kind of narrow down and try to kind of mine that value proposition for more value and more growth for the business. And so, you know, one example is when we started the business, we recognized that when you're mining data, right, you can choose to mine a very specific sort of data or you can mine lots of kinds of data. Right. And we decided that we wanted to mine lots of kinds of data. We wanted to bring in calls and chats and emails and surveys. And that required us to go wide. We had to build, you know, data aggregation techniques to connect to lots of different platforms, because we aren't a social media company. We aren't a survey company, or at least we weren't when we started the company, right? We're not a telephony company. Yet all of those platforms had data that we wanted to be able to analyze. So we had to build essentially the plumbing to build that. That made us go wide, right? Then what we realized was that when we were selling the solution, the most effective value came from the intersection of what one of our product leaders at Clarabridge used to call the digital to care continuum, which is when you think about companies servicing their customers, most companies want to create a very good digital journey where if I'm a customer and I do business with a telephone company, or I, you know, have a relationship with an insurance company. If I can buy the products online, service the products online, troubleshoot, you know, any issues I have online, I can be efficient. I don't take a lot of time. I don't spend a lot of time on the phone, on hold, dealing with agents. That's going to be good for me as an end customer and good for the company. So we have been using the technology to find, when does a digital journey break? Right? When does the website not function, or when there's errors, or when it's confusing and customers end up having to call because they can't solve a problem? And we laser focus on digital to care, right? We spend less time on marketing. We spend less time on sales, at least initially, but we were focusing on digital to care. And that allowed us to go very deep into those two sources, you know, online feedback, as well as chats and phone calls. And then we would often bring in surveys to kind of get a sense after the fact. And what we found was that most big companies over the last 5 to 10 years have been incredibly focused on making things more digital self-service. So that was go deep. And then when COVID hit, we realized that the traditional in-person way of doing business, right, in 2020, so many companies, banks, retailers, they all shut down. And we were evaluating, should we go deeper into contact centers, actual call recordings, right? When a customer is talking to an agent over the phone, or even to a chatbot, right, over an IVR. And we had made the decision to go deeper into that particular channel in 2019. And then when COVID hit, all of a sudden, everybody said, we need to understand what's happening in our contact centers. So that was a bit of good luck, honestly. But the bet was, you know, that's a big, dense, very untapped source of intelligence for most companies. Many companies would, you know, record the call for quality purposes, but they never really applied AI to analyze the call. Mm-hmm. So we were positioned very well when the world wanted to do call analytics, because we'd invested in being able to do that for about, you know, a year and a half before COVID. And then we went really deep into the call center. And went to the call center, we found three or four very interesting use cases just in the call center. One is agent coaching, right? Helping call agents figure out how well they were doing, and when they weren't doing well, we would create essentially an AI generated score that says, here's what you're doing and here's what you need to do to get better. We also found we could use the call analytics to help figure out how to turn short calls into self-service, and how to make long calls shorter by doing kind of process improvements, training improvements, et cetera. And then the third area, which I mentioned earlier, was risk and compliance, right? Whenever you have two people on a phone call, there's always a risk that part of the call goes bad, right? The agent gets frustrated, the customer gets obnoxious, starts swearing at the customer. And when you see those bad calls, there can be the opportunity for risk. So we would be able to flag for risk and risk mitigation. And it could be operational risk, you know, which is companies just putting itself, you know, in a situation where there might be complaints. It could be financial risk, right? A customer is calling a company and trying to defraud the company, right? And you want to be able to find that. Or it could be regulatory risk, right? Which is if you're doing something that could create a situation where, you know, an agency could say, hey, we're going to fine you because you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing. So very quickly, we realized we needed to go really deep in the contact center. And that has sustained the company from really 2020 through 2022. When we look at 2023 and beyond, I'm excited by this use of generative AI, because I think now we can go deeper into not just flagging, you know, risk or flagging opportunities for performance improvement. We can actually use Gen AI to automate the improvement itself, right? And this is where it gets interesting. I can identify what I want to do. You can use Gen AI to basically insert data from one system to another, to build connections to other systems. We're effectively using machines to talk to machines. And I actually think that as we do that, we're going to create almost these organic systems that communicate with each other, because they're going to sense, they're going to determine what to do, and they're going to connect to each other to take action automatically. And then we're going to all as humans have to figure out what we're going to do in our lives, because the machines are going to do so much. But it's the way of the future. I really believe that.
Great. I'm going to change gears a little bit and ask you a question that probably many other people have asked you, that if you wanted to provide some advice to SaaS companies that are maybe starting now, or they are at the early years, and you wanted to guide them, if there are many opportunities, as I can imagine, in CX world or outside CX world, that entrepreneurs are thinking about it and they wanted to start. Of course, I know that you would tell them that whatever you create, make sure there is a value offered to customers. But additionally, what are other advices that you would provide to them when they start?
Yeah, I mean, I could probably write a book one day, maybe I will, on this, because there's a lot I've learned, both from success and frankly from failure as well. One of the things I would say is that when we started, certainly Clarabridge, we were not trying to solve, you know, a very specific problem, right? We were trying to solve a general problem. And I think even though I do believe firmly that it's important to kind of focus on a value that you're going to achieve, it's not necessarily important that you do that when you start the company. Come up with an interesting problem to solve. And then as you solve the problem, then figure out how that problem solution is going to drive value. So don't be afraid to iterate. I think the process of starting a company is very much an agile process. You don't always get it right the first time. This other big sort of, I think, recommendation is, because I think you need to be able to think broadly, you know, go wide and then not be afraid to go deep. Don't be wedded to past decisions when you think about future decisions about the strategy of your company. Sometimes it's important when you don't have any one part of your business doing well to kind of think broadly and to maybe expand your vision and your kind of work that you do. But also when you see, when you do that, you'll often find parts of your business do better than other parts. Don't be afraid to play favorites, right? These are not your kids where you have to love them all equally, right? If a part of the business isn't working, don't be afraid to say, I'm going to redeploy the people on this part over to that part because this is where really the future is. And I think that's important. And then the last thing, again, I keep coming back to this, but in tech, in software, you have to be mindful of the innovation that's around us. And to me, that innovation that has really driven certainly me and the company that I've been part of for the last 20 years almost is AI. I think it's important to always look for ways to automate, to streamline, to transform your own software, your own business with AI. Because if you don't, your competitor will, right?
Yeah, and that's a good point because we live in this at this age, at the point that AI is becoming reality, right? Mm-hmm. So for many years we talked about it, but now we see the reality. Now it can come and just make decisions and take actions and automate. If you are building something today, a new software, a new SaaS company, definitely you need to think about what how AI is going to impact that domain, that market. Because otherwise, if you don't think about it now, then maybe down the road, you may need to change many of the decisions you already have made. So definitely that's the case.
Yes.
Now, do you see kind of your, which school of thoughts you subscribe to, the kind of people who may think AI is going to increase the opportunities and more jobs and more kind of opportunities would exist in the next 10 years than ever? Or do you think that AI is going to actually just narrow down a lot of things would be just done by, you know, automating through AI?
I mean, that is, I think, the existential question for our, you know, our generation, and I think even more for our children's generation. The short answer is, I think it's going to do a little bit of both, right? I think that there are certainly, if you look back at, you know, the waves of industrialization over the last 100 years, right? With every new disruptive innovation, some jobs have gone away and other jobs have been created, right? Mass production, you know, largely limited the artisan class and created the factory worker, right? IT automation largely, took away a lot of the manual work from traditional paper-based, you know, accounting, printing, publishing, other things, but created a whole emerging class of content and media and entertainment that didn't exist, right? And I think right now AI is doing the same thing. It's going to largely, in the world of customer experience, which is where I am, I think the concept of a tier one interaction where a human being, you know, handles the first tier of selling or supporting, you know, a customer, a lot of that is going to be replaced with self-service and with AI. But there will always be exception or edge cases in customer experience where an AI just doesn't have either the maturity or the knowledge or the training or even the empathy to resolve certain kinds of issues. Those will have to go to humans. So I think there'll be a need for a more high empathy, high touch human level person in a lot of parts of the businesses that are going to be disrupted. I also think that we're going to need, you know, we're going to create a whole new world of basically machine teachers, right? Think of them as annotators and trainers that actually help shape the way machines learn about the world. Because that's not going to go away. You can give raw data to an AI and say, tell me what you find. But it's just like training a human child, right? Mm-hmm. Giving them values, giving them ways to look at things, you know, extracting in AI terms, the features that they should be focusing on versus the ones they shouldn't to reduce the noise and the chaos of their learning. That's going to be a job of humans. Because I think we still, you know, I hope are going to be the top species in the planet above the machines. And until I'm proven otherwise, we need to make sure that we teach them the right way. We have to teach our machines well, if you will. So.
So at this point, I would like to ask you if you could please share a book that either you personally liked it or professionally you liked it to the audience and something that you thought, you know, it was impactful in what you are doing.
Yeah, so you gave me a heads up that you were going to ask for that. So I went to my library and I found the book. And not surprisingly, it's actually a book about AI. It's called Competing in the Age of AI. And it's written by Marco Iansiti and Karim Lakhani. It was written about 3 or 4 years ago. And to be honest, I was already pretty passionate about AI before I read the book, but I think it reinforced for me the fact that this was a space that was going to be critical for me to be aware of and to be situationally continuing to learn on. And it was, again, of course, before Gen AI and a lot of the kind of current generation of technologies. But what the book does is it goes through, it's sort of a half Harvard Business School case study and half technology primer. So the case study part of it is it talks about how, new industries have been created, like, banking industries in China, like Tencent, that can make a split decision on whether to give somebody a loan or not, or how existing companies are being transformed either by innovators or by themselves as they make investments in AI. And I think anybody reading this book is going to get a lot of interesting ideas about how do you think about maturing the company that you might be part of, but also what are other people doing in your space or other spaces to maybe get creative about new ideas, new companies you might want to start.
So, fantastic. Thanks a lot. Again, thanks very much for your time. It was great having you here.
Thank you. Always great to talk to you, Armin. Take care.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armin Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to sasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.